Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Critical Theory, a Very Short Introduction by Stephen Eric Bronner, narrated by Justin Price. Preface. Critical Theory, a Very Short Introduction, appeared in its first edition just after the outbreak of the Arab Spring in 2011, Occupy Wall Street in the United States, and anti-austerity demonstrations in southern Europe. This new second edition was finished amid an international counter-revolt that generated the barbaric Syrian civil war and created waves of immigrants seeking entry to the West, resurgent xenophobic neo-fascist parties all over Europe, the triumph of the Tea Party, and the election of Donald Trump as President of the United States in 2016. Reinvigorating the political dimension of critical theory and its ethical purpose is more urgent today than ever before, and there is cause for optimism. Critical theory has become the subject of growing interest in Latin America, Southern Europe, and the Middle East. Other writings of mine on the critical tradition, I am happy to say, have been translated into Portuguese and Spanish. And indeed, the first edition of this book has already been translated into Arabic and Persian. That new audience is more political and more skeptical about older, paralyzing assumptions that have become so much a part of the critical tradition. They are more interested in strengthening solidarity, articulating institutional alternatives, and furthering progressive political struggle in the decades to come. Aiding this effort was the principal aim of my contribution to the excellent series of Very Short Introductions published by Oxford University Press. I like to think that my book had a certain impact, not only as an introduction to critical theory, but also for its political reinterpretation of the tradition. My book explicitly privileged the importance of theory for practice, and vice versa. Understanding critical theory as a transformative enterprise remains the precondition for maintaining its relevance, its uniqueness, and its genuinely radical character, or so I argued. None of that has changed. This second edition corrects minor mistakes, tightens arguments, rectifies faulty formulations, and renders the original text more efficient and expansive. It has also allowed me to better explain the roots of non-identity and the aesthetic dimension of critical theory in a new chapter that treats the influence of cultural modernism. This new edition also stresses the growing popularity and invigoration of the critical tradition outside the West, in just those countries that arguably most require its insights. New forms of critical theory can, and should, offer constructive responses to new forms of authoritarian excess, institutional bigotry, religious extremism, class conflict, and various structural imbalances of power. In light of all this, the changes that I made are more than cosmetic. I only hope that this new second edition of Critical Theory will have the popularity and impact of its predecessor. Introduction. What is critical theory? Philosophy has evidenced a subversive element from its inception. Plato's Apology tells how Socrates was condemned by the Athenian citizenry for corrupting the morals of the young and doubting the gods. There was some truth to that complaint. Socrates called conventional wisdom into question. He subjected long-standing beliefs to rational scrutiny and speculated about concerns that projected beyond the existing order. What became known as critical theory was built upon this legacy. The new philosophical tendency was generated between World War I and World War II, and its most important representatives would wage an unrelenting assault on the exploitation, repression, and alienation embedded within Western civilization. Critical theory refuses to identify freedom with any institutional arrangement or fixed system of thought. It questions the hidden assumptions and purposes of competing theories and existing forms of practice. It has little use for what is known as perennial philosophy. Critical theory insists that thought must respond to the new problems and the new possibilities for liberation that arise from changing historical circumstances. Interdisciplinary and uniquely experimental in character, deeply skeptical of tradition and all absolute claims, Critical theory was always concerned not merely with how things were, but how they might be and should be. This ethical imperative led its primary thinkers to develop a cluster of themes and a new critical method that transformed our understanding of society. Critical theory has many sources. Immanuel Kant identified moral autonomy as the highest value for the individual. He provided critical theory with its definition of scientific rationality and its goal of confronting reality with the prospects of freedom. Meanwhile, Hegel understood consciousness as the motor of history, thinking as linked to practical concerns, and philosophy as its epic comprehended in thought. Critical theorists learned to interpret the particular with an eye on the totality. The moment of freedom appeared in the demand for recognition by the enslaved and the exploited. Both Kant and Hegel incarnated the cosmopolitan and universal assumptions deriving from the European Enlightenment of the 17th and 18th centuries. They relied upon reason to combat superstition, prejudice, cruelty, and the arbitrary exercise of institutional authority. They also speculated about the humane hopes expressed by aesthetics, the redemptive longings of religions, and new ways of thinking about the relation between theory and practice. The young Karl Marx went even farther with his utopian reflections on human emancipation. Critical theory was conceived within the intellectual crucible of Marxism, but its leading representatives were from the start dismissive of economic determinism, the stage theory of history, and any fatalistic belief in the inevitable triumph of socialism. They were concerned less with what Marx called the economic base than the political and cultural superstructure of society. Their Marxism was of a different variety. They highlighted its critical method over its systematic claims, its concern with alienation and reification, its complicated relationship with the ideals of the Enlightenment, its utopian moment, its emphasis upon the role of ideology, and its commitment to resist the deformation of the individual. This complex of themes constitutes the core of critical theory as it was conceived by the leading figures of Western Marxism, Karl Korsch and Georg Lukács. These two thinkers provided the framework for the critical project that later became identified with the Institute for Social Research, or the Frankfurt School. Its principal members included Theodor W. Adorno, notable for his consummate knowledge of music and philosophy, who began his collaboration with the Institute in 1928, but did not become an official member until 10 years later. Erich Fromm, a gifted psychologist who started his 9-year collaboration in 1930, Herbert Marcuse, a philosopher with wide-ranging talents who joined in 1933, Voltaire Benjamin, the most creative of these thinkers, who never officially was a member at all, and Jürgen Habermas, who became its leading philosopher in the aftermath of 1968, and surely the most prolific thinker associated with the Institute. Its guiding light, however, was Max Horkheimer. He brought together these extraordinary intellectuals in order to construct the interdisciplinary basis for a critical theory of society. The Frankfurt School initially believed that its intellectual work would aid the practical prospects for revolutionary action by the proletariat. As the 1930s wore on, however, the revolution degenerated in the Soviet Union, and its prospects in Europe faded. Fascism had audaciously entered political life, and the humane hopes originally associated with modernity appeared increasingly naive. The Frankfurt School registered this historical shift by subjecting long-standing leftist beliefs in the inherently progressive character of science and technology, popular education, and mass politics to withering interrogation. Alienation and reification are the two ideas most commonly associated with critical theory. The former is usually identified with the psychological effects of exploitation and the division of labor, and the latter with how people are treated instrumentally as things through concepts that have been ripped from their historical context. Pioneering studies of alienation and reification had already been undertaken by Western Marxists during the 1920s, but the Frankfurt School provided a unique sense of how these complex categories impacted upon individuals in advanced industrial society. They investigated the ways in which thinking was being reduced to mechanical notions of what is operative and profitable, ethical reflection was tending to vanish, and aesthetic enjoyment was becoming more standardized. Critical theorists noted with alarm how interpreting modern society was becoming ever more difficult. Alienation and reification were thus analyzed in terms of how they imperiled the exercise of subjectivity, robbed the world of meaning and purpose, and turned the individual into a cog in the machine. Auschwitz was seen as incarnating the most radical implications of alienation and reification. It was the watershed event that shattered optimistic assumptions about progress even more radically than the Lisbon earthquake did during the 18th century. With images of the Nazi concentration camps still fresh, Hiroshima and Nagasaki destroyed, new reports emerging about the Soviet gulag and McCarthyism on the rise in the United States, it appeared to the Frankfurt School as if Western civilization had generated not human development, but an unparalleled barbarism. They knew that something more was required from radical thought than the usual stale critique of capitalism. All members of the Frankfurt School agreed on the need for increased education to counteract authoritarian trends, but it remained unclear how effective such education might prove to be in a totally administered society. A new culture industry, arguably the most famous concept associated with critical theory, was constantly striving to lower the lowest common denominator in order to maximize sales. Authentic individual experience and class consciousness were being threatened by the consumerism of advanced capitalism. All this led Horkheimer, Adorno, and Marcuse to claim that the extent to which a work becomes popular, regardless of its political message, is the extent to which its radical impulse will be integrated into the system. These thinkers became champions of an experimental modernist art and, in the charged climate of the post-war period, an Aesopian form of convoluted writing that shielded their radical beliefs. Nevertheless, this esoteric and indirect style of critical theory only increased its appeal among radical intellectuals involved in the uprisings of the 1960s. European radicals applied its ideas to reconfiguring the family, sexuality, and education. They sought to bring about a new utopian sensibility devoid of cruelty and competition. But the Frankfurt School split over the movements connected with the 1960s. Adorno and Horkheimer were skeptical. They questioned the counterculture and the assault on tradition, the sporadic violence and the anti-intellectualism, as well as the comfort radical activists supposedly gave to the enemies of democracy. They identified the mass movements of the 1960s with those of the interwar period, and they associated utopian thinking with totalitarianism. Genuine resistance now seemed to call for highlighting the negative moment within the critical tradition. Adorno, especially, argued that the point was no longer one of merely refusing to identify freedom with any system or collectivity, but rather of conceptualizing the non-identity and heightening the tension between the individual and society. Concern with organized resistance and institutional politics fell by the wayside in favor of an aesthetic philosophical form of critique, or, in the case of Horkheimer, a quasi-religious longing for the totally other. The Frankfurt School still employed the method inherited from Hegel and Marx. Its most politically conservative members still viewed subjectivity as enmeshed within what it resisted, the commodity form, mass culture, and the bureaucratic society. But they cast new suspicions on universal claims, philosophical foundations, and the fixed narrative. Negative dialectics anticipated many concerns associated with postmodernism and poststructuralism. So much so, in fact, that they are now often treated as expressions of critical theory. Deconstructive or post-structuralist approaches invaded the most prestigious journals and disciplines ranging from anthropology and film to religion, linguistics, and political science. They generated new insights on race and gender, as well as the post-colonial world. In the process, however, critical theory lost its ability to offer an integrated critique of society, conceptualize a meaningful politics, and project new ideals of liberation. Textual exegesis, cultural preoccupations, and metaphysical disputations increasingly turned critical theory into a victim of its own success. Chapter 1. The Frankfurt School. The Institute for Social Research was founded in 1923, growing out of a Marxist study group which sought to deal with the practical problems facing the labor movement in the aftermath of the Russian Revolution. This first Marxist think tank was funded by Hermann Weyl. He was an enlightened businessman who made his fortune on the grain market in Argentina. The money was given at the urging of his son, Felix, who considered himself a salon Bolshevik. Felix Weil's close friends included Kurt Albert Gerlach, a social democrat and an economist. He would have become the first director of the Institute. Unfortunately, however, Gerlach died of diabetes. Karl Grunberg thus took over instead. He founded the first official publishing arm of the Institute, the Archive for the History of Socialism and the Labor Movement, which published a number of significant works, including Korsch's Marxism and Philosophy, 1923. Grunberg was joined by Heinrich Grossmann, Friedrich Pollock, Fritz Sternberg, and Karl August Wittfogel. All of them were communists. Still nostalgic for the Democratic Workers' Councils of 1980 to 1921, they envisioned a German Soviet Republic. Their intellectual efforts offer a rich variety of views on capitalist breakdown, the new role of the state, and imperialism. But this group would fade into the background, and the general orientation of the Institute would change in 1930. That was the year in which Max Horkheimer brought together the new inner school for what would become known as the Frankfurt School. The Inner Circle. Horkheimer was born in 1895 near Stuttgart, into the family of a wealthy Jewish businessman. His early school years were undistinguished, and he left high school to work as an apprentice in his father's textile factory. In 1911, however, he made the acquaintance of Friedrich Pollock, who introduced him to philosophy and the social sciences, and who remained a lifelong friend. Horkheimer finished high school after World War I. He flirted with communism, studied a variety of subjects at the University of Frankfurt, and ultimately wrote a dissertation on Kant's Critique of Judgment, 1790. Horkheimer published very little prior to assuming his position as director. That changed following the triumph of Hitler in 1933, when he was busily attempting to relocate the Institute from Frankfurt first to Geneva, then to Paris, and finally to Columbia University in New York City. His essays of the 1930s concentrated on distinguishing critical theory from its philosophical competitors and demonstrating how liberal capitalism had betrayed its original promise by creating the psychological, racial, and political foundations of totalitarianism. Other works dealing with mass culture, instrumental rationality, and the authoritarian state paved the way for Adorno and Horkheimer's classic Dialectic of Enlightenment, 1947. Horkheimer's thinking surely changed over the years. Nevertheless, he always retained his preoccupation with the impact of suffering and the liberating possibilities of individual experience. Horkheimer also remained a champion of interdisciplinary research. Under his leadership, the Frankfurt School attempted to bridge the gap between normative theory and empirical work. His inaugural lecture of 1930 stressed that goal, and, even while in exile, Horkheimer edited a multi-volume interdisciplinary research project, Studies in Prejudice, for the American Jewish Committee. It included Rehearsal for Destruction, 1949, by Paul Massing, which brilliantly analyzed the social origins of anti-Semitism in Imperial Germany. Prophets of Deceit, a Study of the Techniques of the American Agitator, 1950, by Leo Löwenthal and Norbert Guttmann, and the classic The Authoritarian Personality, 1950, by Theodore W. Adorno and a host of researchers. Horkheimer's radicalism was inflamed by the Russian Revolution and the German Spartacus Revolt of 1919, but Stalin's purges and the emergence of a terror apparatus took their toll. Horkheimer ultimately broke not just with communism, but with Marxism as well. His politics had shifted to the right even before he brought the Institute back to Germany and served as rector of the University of Frankfurt from 1951 to 1953. Horkheimer wound up opposing the anti-imperialist struggle in Algeria, supporting the Vietnam War, and denouncing the revolts associated with 1968. At this point, his concern with the negation of misery took a new turn. Looking back to the Old Testament, which prohibited depicting the divine, he came to believe that preserving the idea of resistance was now possible only through the all-encompassing negation of reality and the longing for emancipation. The sacred, or better, the otherworldly, became the vantage point for confronting the profane. He took the critique of enlightenment to its farthest extreme. Friends noted a growing flirtation with Catholicism. All links between theory and practice were sundered. Critical theory was already imperiled when Max Horkheimer died at the age of 78. Erich Fromm was one of Horkheimer's closest friends from the early days. Fromm's specialty was psychology, but he was also deeply versed in theological matters. In fact, the Psychoanalytic Institute in Berlin that he established with his first wife, Frieda Reichmann, was dubbed the Tora Poeticum. Fromm was a prolific writer and intellectually daring. He was among the very first to link the thought of Sigmund Freud with that of Marx. Today, however, Fromm is not taken very seriously. He is usually remembered for what his more academic critics considered how-to books, like The Art of Loving, 1956, that offered a responsible alternative to the way love is presented by mass culture, feel-good works like The Heart of Man, 1964, that provided a counterweight to cynical assaults on Western culture, and supposedly superficial studies about international affairs like May Man Prevail, 1961, that sensibly called for the elimination of nuclear weapons in a tempering of the Cold War spirit. Fromm's Escape from Freedom, 1941, is remembered for its penetrating analysis of totalitarianism. His great inquiry into the anatomy of human destructiveness, 1973, however, has been unjustly forgotten. Fromm grew up in an Orthodox Jewish family. He was instructed as a child by learned rabbis like Nehemiah Noble and especially Salman Baruch Rabinko. His dissertation was The Jewish Law, Toward a Sociology of the Jewish Diaspora, 1922, and his earliest works treated religious themes, The Sabbath, 1927, and, with a Marxian twist, The Dogma of Christ, 1930. His interest in the psychological appeal and ethical impulse provided by religion never fully disappeared, in spite of the atheism he adopted during the 1920s, and he struck a popular chord with his humanistic reinterpretation of the Old Testament in You Shall Be as Gods, 1967. Fromm's attempt to develop a materialist psychology reflected the original commitment of critical theory to an all-embracing social transformation, emphasis upon the practical character of psychoanalysis, its connection with resisting repression and fostering humanistic values, would mark his career. Fromm helped found the Mexican Psychoanalytic Association in 1962, and he became one of the most influential figures in the development of psychoanalysis in Latin America. A staunch opponent of the Vietnam War and American imperialism, a supporter of countless progressive causes, Fromm advocated a non-bureaucratic and participatory form of communitarian socialism. He was also unquestionably the finest stylist and the most lucid writer produced by the Frankfurt School. Fromm finally broke with the Institute in 1940. Other members of the inner circle clearly envied his popularity, though there were legitimate political and philosophical disagreements with him as well. By the end of his life, he had little to do with any of his former associates at the Institute. As much as any member of the Frankfurt School, however, Erich Fromm remained true to the concrete moment, the humanistic spirit, and the transformative purpose of critical theory. Herbert Marcuse was his only real competitor as an intellectual influence on the New Left. Marcuse's political history reaches back over his time with the Office of Strategic Services from 1941 until the 1950s, where he played an important and progressive role in shaping American policy toward Western Europe, to his participation as a young man in the Spartacus Revolt of 1918-19. His early essays sought to link historical materialism with historicity, or the phenomenological structures whereby social reality is experienced by the individual. Similar concerns informed Hegel's Ontology and the Theory of Historicity, 1932, which contributed to a growing Hegel Renaissance in Europe, while Reason and Revolution, 1941, offered a seminal interpretation of the great thinker's relevance for critical theory. Marcuse also authored a number of stunning essay collections. Always cognizant of the utopian potential exhibited by art, yet still concerned with practical forms of resistance, Marcuse envisioned a break with the established order. Nevertheless, his speculative ventures were complemented by various sociological and political studies. After joining the Institute for Social Research in 1933, Marcuse interrogated the liberal state, the connection between monopoly capitalism and fascism, and the degeneration of communism. His later work anticipated the role of the new social movements in response to the alienation of advanced industrial society. Optimistic concerning the prospects for change in 1968, he also envisioned the conservative reaction that followed. Concepts like the happy consciousness, repressive desublimation, and the great refusal were all popularized by him. His signature work, One Dimensional Man, 1964, virtually brought critical theory to the United States and, through its citations, introduced many young intellectuals to the Frankfurt School. Marcuse always saw himself as working within the tradition of historical materialism, but he was flexible in his approach and was a prophet of cultural transformation. Herbert Marcuse incarnated the radical political moment of critical theory for a generation of young radicals in the United States and much of the world. Volta Benjamin was, by contrast, unknown in the United States until the preeminent political theorist Hannah Arendt published a portrait of him in The New Yorker and edited his sterling collection of essays, Illuminations, 1969. Benjamin thereafter became celebrated as a unique thinker of brilliance and uncanny insight. Another anthology of his essays, Reflections, 1986, strengthened that assessment. Benjamin's writings range from his lovely autobiographical works, One Way Street, 1928, and Berlin Childhood around 1900, 1950, which appeared originally as a set of newspaper articles in the 1930s, to an abstruse study of the Baroque titled The Origins of German Tragic Drama, 1928, and his unfinished Arcades Project, 1982, which comprised a few thousand quotations and offered a veritable hall of mirrors for understanding modernity. With the new popularity accorded postmodernism and other forms of philosophical subjectivism in the United States during the late 1970s, Benjamin's fame soon reached epic proportions. A library of secondary works has appeared, and almost every volume of his selected writings has become an academic bestseller. Benjamin was another son from a wealthy Jewish family. Born in Berlin, he received his doctorate from the University of Bern in 1919. He then became an itinerant writer and never held a steady job. There is a sense in which Benjamin incarnated the Luftmensch, the impractical individual whose imagination has lifted him beyond the world. His work was marked by a preoccupation with the fungible character of language, the nature of memory, and the seemingly mundane experiences of everyday life, like eating, storytelling, and book collecting. All of these, Benjamin believed, shed light on broader social trends. His explicitly political writings were uninspired and, as exemplified by the Moscow Diary of 1926-27, they offer little insight into the monumental events of his time. But it is a different matter when it comes to his studies on the poetry of Charles Baudelaire, the elective affinities by J.W. von Goethe, or the novels of Franz Kafka and Marcel Proust. The same holds for Benjamin's articles on architecture, photography, romanticism, and translation. His fascinating and provocative essays explore the aesthetic impact of modernity on individual experience and everyday life. Influenced by both Gershom Scholem, his childhood friend who became a legendary scholar of Jewish mysticism, and the Marxist playwright Bertolt Brecht, Benjamin attempted to fuse a messianic outlook with what became a growing interest in historical materialism. reacting against the fatalism of scientific socialism, contemptuous of its transformation of the classless society into an unattainable.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?